41. With his hands clasped behind his back and his chin thrust forward aggressively, Rear Admiral Sir Percy Howe sucked in his lower lip and nibbled it reflectively.
"What was our last substantial sighting on Blucher?" he asked at last.
"A month ago, sir, 2 days before the outbreak of war. Sighting reported by SS Tigerberg. Latitude 0.27 degrees north, longitude 52.16 degrees east. Headed southeast, estimated speed 18 knots.
"And a hell of a lot of good that does us,"
Sir Percy interrupted his flag captain and glared at the vast Admiralty plot of the Indian Ocean.
"She could be back in Bremerhaven by now."
"She could be, sir." The flag captain nodded, and Sir Percy glanced at him and permitted himself a wintry smile.
"But you don't believe that, do you, Henry?"
"No, sir, I don't. During the last 30 days, 8 merchantmen have disappeared between Aden and Loreno Marquez. Nearly 250,000 tons of shipping. That's the Blucher's work."
"Yes, it's the Blucher, all right,"
agreed the Admiral, and reached across the plot to pick up the black counter-labelled Blucher that lay on the wide green expanse of the Indian Ocean. A respectful silence held the personnel of the plotting room, South Atlantic and Indian Oceans, while they waited for the great man to reach his decision. It was a long time coming. He stood bouncing the Blucher in the palm of his right hand, his grey eyebrows erect like the spines of a hedgehog's back, as his forehead creased in thought. A full minute they waited.
"Refresh my memory of her class and commission."
Like most successful men, Sir Percy would not hurry a decision when there was time to think, and the duty lieutenant who had anticipated his request stepped forward with the German Imperial Navy list open at the correct page. "Blucher, commissioned August the 16th, 1905, B-class heavy cruiser. Main armament, 8 9-inch guns. Secondary armament, 6 6-inch guns." The lieutenant finished his reading and waited quietly.
"Who is her captain?"
Sir Percy asked, and the lieutenant consulted an addendum to the list. "Otto von Kleiner, Count, previously commanded the light cruiser Sturm Vogel."
"Yes," said Sir Percy, "I've heard of him."
And he replaced the counter on the plot, keeping his hand on it.
"A dangerous man to have here south of Suez."
And he pushed the counter up towards the Red Sea and the entrance to the canal, where the tiny red shipping lanes amalgamated into a thick artery.
"Or here."
And he pushed it down towards the Cape of Good Hope, around which were curved the same red threads that joined London to Australia and India. Sir Percy lifted his hand from the black counter and left it sitting menacingly upon the shipping lanes.
"What force have we deployed against him so far?"
And, in answer, the flag captain picked up a wooden pointer and touched in turn the red counters that were scattered about the Indian Ocean. "Pegasus and Renounce in the north, Eagle and Plunger sweeping the southern waters, sir."
"What further force can we spare, Henry?"
"Well, sir, Orion and Bloodhound are in Simonstown," and he touched the nose of the African continent with the pointer.
"Orion? That's Manderson, isn't it?"
"Yes, sir."
"And who has Bloodhound?"
"Little, sir."
"Good."
Sir Percy nodded with satisfaction.
"A 6-inch cruiser and a destroyer should be able to deal with Blucher."
And he smiled again.
"Especially with a Helion like Charles Little handling the Bloodhound. I played golf with him last summer. He damn nigh drove the 16th green at St. Andrews."
The flag captain glanced at the Admiral, and on the strength of the destroyer captain's reputation, decided to permit himself an inanity.
"The young ladies of Cape Town will mourn his departure, sir." "We must hope that Capitan Sursay Otto von Kleiner will mourn his arrival,"
chuckled Sir Percy. Daddy likes you very much. Your father is a man of exquisite good taste. Commander, the Honourable Charles Little conceded gallantly and rolled his head to smile at the young lady who lay beside him on a rug in the dappled shade beneath the pine trees. Can't you ever be serious? Helen, my sweet, at times I can be deadly serious. Oh, you! And his companion blushed prettily as she remembered certain of Charles's recent actions, which would make her father hastily revise his judgment. I value your father's good opinion, but my chief concern is that you endorse it. And the girl sat up slowly, and while she stared at him, her hands were busy brushing the pine needles from the glorious tangle of her hair, readjusting the fastenings of her blouse, spreading the skirts of her riding habit to cover sweet legs clad in dark, tall, polished leather boots. She stared at Charles Little, and ached with the strength of her want. It was not a sensual need, she felt, but an overpowering obsession to have this man as her very own. To own him in the same way she already owned diamonds and furs and silk and horses and peacocks and other beautiful things. His body sprawled out on the rug, with all the unconscious grace of a reclining leopard. A secret little smile tugged at the corners of his lips, and his eyelids drooped to mask the sparkle of his eyes. His recent exertions had dampened the hair that flopped forward onto his forehead. There was something satanical about him, an air of wickedness, and Helen decided it was the slant of the eyebrows, the way his ears lay flat against his temples, but were pointed like those of a satyr, yet they were pink and smooth as those of an infant. "I think you have the devil's ears," she said. And then she blushed again and scrambled to her feet, avoiding Charles's arm that reached out for her. "Enough of that," she giggled, and ran to the thoroughbred hunter that was tied near in the forest. "Come on," she called as she mounted. Charles stood up lazily and stretched. He tucked the tail of his shirt into his breeches, folded the rug on which they had lain, and went to his own horse. At the edge of the pine forest, they checked their mounts and sat looking down over the Constantina Valley. "Isn't it beautiful?" she said. "It is indeed," he agreed. "I meant the view." "And so did I." Twice, in the 6 days he had known her, she had led him up this mountain and subjected him to the temptation. Below them lay 6,000 acres of the richest land in all of Africa. "When my brother Hubert was killed, there was no one left to carry it on, just my sister and I. And we are only girls. Poor Daddy isn't so well any more. He finds it such a strain." Charles let his eyes move lazily from the great squat buttress of Table Mountain on the left, across the lush basin of vineyards below him, and then on to where the glittering wedge of False Bay drove into the mountains. "Doesn't the homestead look lovely from here?" Helen drew his attention to the massive Dutch-gabled residence with its attendant outbuildings grouped in civility behind it. "I am truly impressed by the magnificence of the stud fee," Charles murmured, purposely slurring the last two words, and the girl glanced at him in surprise, beginning to bridle.
"I beg your pardon?"
"It is truly magnificent scenery," he amended. Her persistent efforts at ensnaring him were beginning to bore Charles. He had teased and avoided more artful huntresses.
"Charles," she whispered, "how would you like to live here? I mean, forever?"
And Charles was shocked. This little provincial had no understanding whatsoever of the rules governing the game of flirtation. He was so shocked that he threw back his head and laughed. When Charles laughed, it sent slivers of delight through every woman within 100 yards. It was a merry sound with underlying tones of sensuality. His teeth were very white against the sea tan of his face, and the muscles of his chest and upper arms tensed into bold relief beneath the silk shirt he wore. Helen was the only witness of this particular performance, and she was helpless as a sparrow in a hurricane. Eagerly she leaned across the space between their horses and touched his arm.
"You would like it, Charles, wouldn't you?"
She did not know that Charles Little had a private income of £20,000 a year, and that when his father died he would inherit the title Viscount Southerton and the estates that went with it. She did not know that one of those estates would swallow her father's own three times over. Nor did she know that Charles had passed by willing young ladies with twice her looks, 10 times her fortune, and 100 times her breeding.
"You would, Charles. I know you would."
So young, so vulnerable, that he stopped the flippant reply before it reached his lips. "Helen," he took her hand, "I am a sea creature. We move with the wind and the waves." And he lifted her hand to his lips. A while she sat, feeling the warm pressure of his lips upon her flesh and the burn of tears behind her eyes. Then she snatched her hand away and wheeled her horse. She lifted the leather-writhing crop and slashed the glossy black shoulder between her knees. Startled, the stallion jumped forward in a dead run back along the road towards the Constantina Valley. Charles shook his head and grimaced with regret. He had not meant to hurt her. It had been an escapade, something to fill the waiting days while Bloodhound went through the final stages of her refit. But Charles had learned to harden himself to the ending of his adventures, to the tears and tragedy. "Shame on you, you heartless cat," he said aloud, and touching his mount with his heels, ambled in pursuit of the galloping stallion. He caught up with the stallion in the stable yards. A groom was walking it, and there were darker sweat patches on its coat, and the barrel of its chest still heaved with laboured breathing. Helen was nowhere in sight, but her father stood at the stable gates, a big man with a square-cut black beard, picked out with grey. "Enjoy your ride." "Thank you, Mr. Aus." Charles was non-committal, and the older man glanced significantly at the blown stallion before going on. "There's one of your sailors been waiting for you an hour." "Where is he?" Charles's manner abruptly altered, becoming instantly businesslike. "Here, sir." From the deep shade of the stable doorway, a young seaman stepped out into the bright sunlight. "What is it, man?" Impatiently, Charles acknowledged his salute. "Captain Manderson's compliments, sir, and you're to report aboard HMS Orion with all possible speed. There's a motor car waiting to take you to the base, sir."
"An untimely summons, Commander." Aus gave his opinion, lounging against the worked stone gateway. "I fear we will see no more of you for a long time."
But Charles was not listening. His body seemed to quiver with suppressed excitement, the way a good gun dog reacts to the scent of the bird.
"Sailing orders," he whispered. "At last! At last!"
There was a heavy southeast swell battering Cape Point, so the sea spray wreathed the beam of the lighthouse on the cliffs above. A flight of Malgas came in so high towards the land that they caught the last of the sun and glowed pink above the dark water. Bloodhound cleared Cape Hangclip and took the press for the South Atlantic on her shoulder, staggered for it with a welter of white water running waist-deep past her foredeck gun turrets. Then, in retaliation, she hurled herself at the next swell, and Charles Little, on her bridge, exulted at the vital movement of the deck beneath his feet. "Bring her round to 050. 050, sir," repeated his navigating lieutenant. "Revolutions for 17 knots, pilot." Almost immediately the beat of the engines changed, and her actions through the water became more abandoned. Charles crossed to the angle of the flimsy little bridge and looked back into the dark mountain-line moor of False Bay. 2 miles astern, the shape of HMS Orion melted into the dying light. "Come along, old girl, do try and keep up," murmured Charles Little, with the scorn that a destroyer man feels for any vessel that cannot cruise at 20 knots. Then he looked beyond Orion at the land. Below the massif of Table Mountain, near the head of the Constantina Valley, a single pinprick of light showed.
"There'll be fog tonight, sir,"
the pilot spoke at Charles's elbow, and Charles turned without regret to peer over the bows into the gathering night. "Yes, a good night for pirates."